I mean, the sermon really has already been preached. I mean, she said it, really. They called Harriet Tubman the Black Moses, and honestly, y'all, she sort of stole my thunder. But I'm going to do it. I'm going to do my best. Beyonce was right. Beyonce was right. The Nile must have run through their bodies. Now, before you look at me crazy, let me tell you about it. See, it doesn't really hit you until you're standing there. See, for me, it wasn't the actual Nile, but it was the Port of Charleston, where I stood last October, where you could really feel it. I was down there with my classmates for a conference, the annual meeting of the Association of African American Life and History, founded by Carter G. Woodson, the same person who founded Negro History Week, now Black History Month. We had some free time, we wanted some food, and so we asked where to go, and they said, go to Fleet's Landing, downtown Charleston. We called our Ubers and headed down that way. Our driver was a seventh generation Black Charlestonian who wanted us to see everything and tell the story of the Charleston that he knew to our group of Black Howard historians. He was excited to meet people who would care about his ancestors' past. Oh, let me drive you around the city a little bit before we get to the restaurant. So he drove us to Emmanuel AME Church. You know, Denmark Vesey planned an insurrection there. And then he took us next door. You know, the Citadel is right there, and they put the fort up to scare people against future rebellions. Oh, and yeah, that spot that y'all are going to, that spot, you know it's on the water, right? And you can see Fort Sumter right there. You know, the slave market isn't too far from there either. You know, you'll be right there on the water. He said, you know, I'm not going to lie to you. There's something about that water. The people who came out of it, the people who were drawn from it, the people who had it flowing through their bodies. There's something about that water. He was right. And as soon as I stood there, I could smell the water. I could taste the mist in the air coming from the water. I could feel the death in the water. The dead bodies lying deep in the water. Something happens to you when you stand at the Port of Charleston or any port where enslaved people entered this country, but especially the Port of Charleston. When you stand there, when you take in the air, taste, feel, and smell and see the waters where the Atlantic meets the Cooper River and the Ashley River and Fort Sumter is off in the distance, you can feel something heavy, something real, something that occurred a couple hundred years ago, but it feels like it's happening right now. You can see the slave ships coming one by one like airplanes landing at Dulles or DCA. You can see the people, see the routes that they took in, the human inventory they must have declared. You can see how the waves parted for the water to split, how the currents buoyed, how the ships carried Black bodies into this country enslaved and shackled. You can hear the screams. You can feel the pain. You can be haunted. You will be haunted. You will be haunted by their trauma. You will feel their presence when you stand at that water. You will see their blood and water, the life that flowed through them and out of them, the life that they tried to persevere as they floated on top of that water. You will see, as Nicole Hannah Jones notes, that they were made a people on that water. And perhaps, just maybe, you might inquire about who they were. Who they were before they came onto those waters. What other waters had flowed through their bodies as they clung for dear life? Who were those people? Who are these people whose presence you still feel when you stand at the port of Charleston. Who were these people whose life we're trying to understand today? Who were these people? Well, there were people, as Beyonce put it, who the Nile ran through their bodies. There were people, as Jesse Jackson put it, who were somebody. There were people, as Sojourner Truth put it, who were women too. There were people, as Gaylord Wilmore said, embodied a sense of radicalism because they knew that race was an inherent problem as a part of Western society. There were people, as Nicole Hannah-Jones said, who perfected this democracy. There were people, as James Cone said, had the God of the oppressed on their side. There were people, as Toni Morrison put it, who were indeed beloved. There were people, as James Baldwin put it, to deal with the fire this time. There were people, as W.B. Du Bois put it, who had a double consciousness. There were people, as Malcolm X put it, who were stolen from their homes and didn't come here on the Mayflower, but came here in the belly of the white lion in other ships, ships named after our Lord and Savior, Jesus Christ. And yet before they were stolen, they had an African past, Amaka, an African origin, an African identity, an African moral compass, an African cosmology, an African political ideology, an African economy, an African sense of hospitality, an African sense of humanity, an African consciousness. They were an African people. Yoruba and Mandinka, Fulani and Hausa, Asante and Wolof, Bassa and Kru, Igbo and Fanti, Mende and Fa and Kisi. They were Bantu speakers, products of the great Bantu migration. They were originators in the concept of civilization. They were ancestors of all of humanity. They were birthed in East Africa, and the Nile flowed through their bodies. So maybe you've heard this articulated before, or maybe you haven't, or maybe you're skeptical. But here's the deal. We cannot do Black History Month or celebrate Black religion or even rightfully honor Dr. King if we're not aware of the people he came from. The people they came from. The people we come from. The people I come from. It all begins with Africa. With their African identity, their African past. And before you tell me, well, Africa isn't a monolith, they had problems there, there's no one way to be African, I get all that. But we miss something fundamentally if we don't understand the relative cohesion of pre-colonial African identities, the relative similarities of pre-colonial African cultures, the relative and different and alternative moral emphasis of pre-colonial African thought. The people who became Black in America and the religion that they practice begins in Africa. And we have a moral duty to understand that land and those people and their history, for the Nile certainly ran through their bodies, and that statement alone should give us pause to understand. See, if you allow me to be a historian for just a little bit, historians and archaeologists tell us that the Sahara used to be a rainforest. Great animals and peoples lived there and drank from its many water sources. But as it began to dry up, the people who lived there had to seek new sources of water. So they were drawn to the Niger River Valley in the west, in the Nile River Valley in the east. One people spread in two different directions at first, and in many different directions, and then all over the continent. Their identity is shared. They form the great civilizations along these river valleys. They develop great ideas about themselves, about their world, about how to relate to their world, how to live in it fully and faithfully. They were actors in human history, agents for humanity, scholars who helped found disciplines, disciplines like math and philosophy, writing and cartography. They were people with a moral imagination, people with a moral dilemma, people who contributed to the Bible. People who contributed to the Bible. They had something to say about God and how to engage her. They saw God as a single entity, a oneness, a monotheistic being, so to speak. Ancient Egyptians and ancient Akan. Judaism, Christianity borrows from their concepts, their ideas about God, because they have something to teach us. Believe they have something to teach us? Do you believe that in that history there's something to teach you about the moral dilemmas of your life and the spiritual crises you face? Do you believe that if we were to study their past and how they did it and how they dealt with it and how they made meaning and constructed their own identity and humanity and personhood, that our lives could be enriched today? Do you believe that enslaved people and their ancestors and their descendants have something to say to us? They're studying their lives, telling their stories, honoring their bodies, venerating their memories, evoking their moral imaginations, using their religious languages, practicing their spiritual disciplines, reciting their origin stories. Has something to teach us, might free us, might liberate us, might save us, that word that y'all like. See, we have many conversations in this place about what is wrong with where we are, about what we struggle with, about the despair we experience and face, about the abuse of power we are witnessing, about the rampant corruption, about the thriving of white supremacy, about the utter lack of ethics and justice, the fear that the democracy in the nation that so many of us deeply love might crumble, might come to its demise. And these are concerns that we take seriously. But what comes up for me when I think about these questions, what comes up for me when I think about this, is why not turn to a moral system, a theological worldview, some spiritual practices that will help us get through and deal with this situation? What better place to turn to? What better people to turn to than the people who know this dilemma oh so well? The people who know the failures, the lies, the brutality, the violence, the terror, the tragedy, the tragedy, the tragedy, the tragedy, the tragedy, the tragedy of this society well, because they have been at the bottom of it. And yet they've somehow figured out how to live. Why not turn to them for wisdom? Why not look to them to see what they have to say, in hopes that we can finally have the life that we want, that we need, that is dependent upon? So you see, maybe I'm ranting now, Lauren, so stop me. But it's funny how today is Martin Luther King Jr. Sunday, where politicians and white church leaders will invoke his words, visit the churches where he preached, invite his associates and scholars who study him to come and speak. They'll take one day out of the year to pay lip service to him, but they will not, Maria, they will not fully listen to him. Perhaps he wasn't just a dreamer. Perhaps he was a builder. Perhaps he was an architect. Perhaps he had the blueprint for our democracy, for how our democracy could work, for how our democracy should work, for how our churches should be organized, for how our lives should be lived. Perhaps he was trying to be a founding father of a new nation and a founding father of a new church. And yet, despite the lip service we offer him, we walk right past his wisdom and insight and vision that he had to offer us when he pressed us each and every day of his life towards justice, love, and peace. Perhaps he was an architect and had the blueprint, not just a dreamer, the blueprint. But yet we walk past his wisdom and insight every single day. We keep him in the past, and he's not alone. So much wisdom has come from black bodies and black people, black moral imagination, black religion, and yet each and every year, each and every day, each and every moment, we ignore maybe our greatest treasures for reasons I cannot explain. We ignore maybe our greatest treasures for reasons I cannot explain. So I won't let us do it anymore. I refuse to participate in that anymore. And you know what? You know what? The Bible actually agrees with me on this. See, in our text this morning, the Bible won't let us keep walking past the wisdom of the oppressed, the wisdom of the people who were born on the Nile, the wisdom of the people who had the Nile flowing through their bodies. See, the Bible puts it plainly for the whole world to see, and especially for American Christians to see, that it is the oppressed ones who have the best ideas about God. It is those who are in a moral dilemma and whose social location places them in situations where they have to devise a mechanism of survival for the sake of their personhood, often from the heart of empire. The Bible suggests that they should be the ones that we model our religious lives after. Is that not the story here? Exodus begins with these words, "Sally, a king came to power who did not know Joseph." And already it's making it clear what this is about, oppressed people, because he did not know Joseph. He did not know what Joseph did for his kingdom. Remember, biblical scholars, what Joseph did for his kingdom? The king came up and he did not know Joseph. He did not remember Joseph. And so the Bible, in the very first chapter of Exodus, places us in it with this question: what happens when you live in a society when a king comes to power but does not remember the true architects of that society? The true people that saved them from disaster, the true ones whose labor and bodies and lives ensured prosperity. What happens? Is that the story in America today? Has a king arisen in America who does not know Joseph? Has a president arisen who does not know Martin? In this eighth verse of this first chapter of this second book, the Bible wants us to understand this dilemma, this question, that the oppressed have something to say about God. So it keeps going. So it tells the story of midwives who practice civil disobedience. They refuse to carry out unjust orders. But it keeps going. It wants to make it clear that it wants us to be equipped to deal with the dilemma that we might find ourselves in. So it tells the story about a king who keeps pushing, who has vicious executive orders about concentration camps. And he wants us to see that this is the context, that is this wickedness. When wickedness is on the throne, violence is the public policy, evil is in the air, and death is in the waters. The Bible paints the picture for us. The Bible tells us this is the situation, this is the condition, and this is the time that God speaks. Not through Pharaoh, or even Joseph, or even other would-be major actors. In literature, you call this a reversal in a novel. But it's through the actions of a nameless couple who have a child, and they refuse to let him be killed by the empire. So they place him on the Nile. What would it look like if we refuse to let our children be killed by the toxic stuff of the empire? So we develop some blueprints for freedom for them. They place him on the Nile, hoping that what runs through him might be just as powerful as what he floats atop, and just as powerful as what is against him, and just enough to save him. Hoping that what runs through him and all of him is powerful enough to deal with what is against them. And so, It is Pharaoh's own daughter who sees his humanity, who disobeys the wickedness of her father, who risks exile for herself, who names him Moses, for she draws him out of the water. And she sees what Moses' mother wanted her to see. She sees what God needed her to see. She sees what too many of us refuse to see. Too many of us refuse to see that the Nile runs through that black boy's body, and that the forces inside of him are more powerful than the forces against him and the forces that she benefits from. Walter Brueggemann puts it this way, that their collective acts of courage, the alliance between the princess and the slave, is what saves all of Israel. And I could preach just on that, an alliance between a princess and a slave. Imagine what this country would look like if there were more alliances between the descendants of white American princesses and the descendants of enslaved people. So this princess, this daughter of the king, recognizes that if she won't yield her authority for good, then why have it at all? So she sees that this baby has something inside of him, something flowing through him, something necessary for them. She sees that Beyonce is right, that the Nile is flowing in his body and that the gift is there for them. She sees that the Nile is flowing in his body, that his natural is so exotic that the blacker the berry, the sweeter the fruit, the deeper the wounded, the deeper the roots. The Nile is flowing in his body. And that same Nile that gave birth to civilizations, that gave her father authority, that feeds a continent, that originated human life, that holds it down for her people, that same water is inside of Moses, and she could do nothing to stop that, so she might as well join him and recognize what she had before her. And the question for us, my last question for you is, will we recognize what is before us? Will we recognize that the history of black people and that the origins of the black religious imagination has the Nile running through its body? Will we recognize that the Bible that we hold sacred has the Nile running through its body? Will we recognize that Africa symbolizes through the Nile runs through the history of the church, through the body of Christ, through the body of the church, through the body of this society, through the body of our lives together, that the Nile can run through us, through the people born on the waters, the people drawn from the waters, the people who entered this country through the waters, Cooper and Ashley, James and Potomac, Delaware and Missouri, Grande and Mississippi. The people whose identity begins on the waters of Africa, Niger and Zambezi, the River Congo and the River Senegal, Lake Victoria and Lake Chad, the African shores of the Atlantic and the African shores of the Indian, the Mediterranean and the Red Sea, that the people who have the Nile in their body might help us. Well, Beyonce is right, the Nile runs through her body. The Nile runs through my body. The Nile can run through our body. The Nile should run through your body. The Nile can run through your body, but you gotta drink the water. You gotta dive in the water. You gotta get in the water. You gotta live next to the water. So won't you do it? Won't you let the Nile run through your body? Won't we let the Nile run through the body of this place and embrace the source and the people who carry its wisdom? Won't you let the Nile run through you?